Can we start with maybe understanding what the investigation was about that you know, you were involved in, why you started that investigation, and maybe the scope, how you got to it. If you can maybe set the stage for that, maybe then we can proceed with a few other things. Maybe is that a good starting point for you?
Yes.
Sure.
About 10 years ago, myself and another reporter at the Wall Street Journal, Rebecca Ballhaus, and I wrote a series of stories over several years looking at the stock holdings, the financial investments of members of Congress. The rules in Washington are different for public officials in various branches of the government. In that case, we're looking at the legislative branch or Congress, which makes the laws for the country. And and the rules that they have for members of Congress and their staff are that there really are no rules. You're allowed to invest in whatever you want to invest, as long as you make those investments public on an annual basis for voters and the public to determine. So, you know, what we found, not surprisingly, if there are no rules, you know, people are doing kind of crazy things. You know, lawmakers who were on the committees that, you know, oversaw the railroad industry had stock in railroads, and lawmakers who were writing the healthcare laws had stock in pharmaceutical companies. And all this was perfectly legal. What those series, that series of stories, however, led to a law being passed called the Stock Act, which said that members of Congress, while they're allowed to invest in anything they want, they're not allowed to invest based on non-public inside information that they hear on Capitol Hill. So that was sort of an advancement in the rules for Congress. And that sort of got us thinking, well, what are the rules in other parts of the government, and what are those employees doing? So members of Congress are pretty high profile. There's 535 of them. You know, they're elected by the people, and you know, people know their names. But we realize that in the executive branch, which is, you know, from the president on down to, you know, the dozens of alphabet soup agencies, from the FDA to the SEC to the FDIC, the people who ran those agencies, who are in many ways just as powerful as members of Congress, maybe even more powerful because they can make rules and regulations without, you know, much public scrutiny. No one had looked at their trading and what the rules were for the stocks investments that they had. So don't ask me why it took us 10 years to move from one topic to the next, but either way, about a year ago, a year and a half ago now, we started trying to figure out how do we look at the financial investments of top officials in the executive branch. It turned out to be a little more complicated than we thought. All senior members of the executive branch are required, just like members of Congress, to fill out annual financial disclosure forms where they list what stocks they have, what bonds they have, what credit card debt they have, what their mortgages are like. But unlike Congress, it's hard to find those forms. For one, each agency keeps their own records. No agency puts them on a website. For Congress, I could, you know, in 30 seconds, I could get you the financial disclosure form of any member of Congress that you named. For officials at the EPA, for example, we had to call the EPA. The EPA requires us to fill out a form. In the form, we have to say whose forms we're looking for. That becomes a bit of a process. Some agencies said that we had to name, in order to get the financial disclosure forms from employees, we had to request the forms by name. And, you know, I don't know all the names of the people who work at the Food and Drug Administration. So then we had to figure out how to get those names. And they're not in a, turns out that was hard to do in some cases. So for some agencies, we had to file a Freedom of Information Act request and say, hey, just give me all the names of your employees. You know, that took a couple months. Anyway, skipping forward a bit, once we had filed all the request forms for these agencies, then the agency started sending us the financial disclosure forms for their top employees. We asked for 5 years worth of forms because we wanted to go back several administrations. And then we started getting thousands and thousands and thousands of forms from each agency. We were trying to get to 50 agencies in order to have a nice round number. In order to do that, we requested the forms of about 70 agencies. So one other thing to add is that, as I mentioned, when we're looking at the stock trading forms for members of Congress, there were no rules. Members of Congress can invest in whatever they want. The rules for the executive branch are different. In fact, they're much tougher. There's a criminal law approved in 1978, I believe, that says that you are not, that senior members of the executive branch are not allowed to invest in companies in which they can influence the company's stock price through their work. So in a way, while we're pulling together all these forms and all these documents, we were sort of thinking we may not find anything in these documents. That turned out not to be the case.
So I want to go back to one thing that you said about don't ask me, which is why it took you 10 years to, you know, change from one topic to another. If I may ask, like, why did it take you like a decade?
That's a great question. I think in part it was, well, one, you know, as a reporter or as anyone in anyone's job, you know, you've got multiple priorities and competition for your time. We had written these stories about stock trading in Congress. And then I think I just moved on to different topics. I sort of always saw this investigation into the executive branch financial holdings as something I wanted to do, but I was sort of intimidated by it because there's 535 members of Congress. As I mentioned, it's very easy to get their forms. You know, going through 535 forms takes a little while, but you know, it all can be done. The executive branch was a whole different animal that I didn't understand. There's just so much information that I was a little intimidated to get started. I mean, if you just take one agency, let's say the Federal Communications Commission, or a better one, the U.S. Agriculture Department, let's say, they have tens and tens of thousands of employees. I didn't know anyone at the agency. I didn't know how to get the forms. I don't exactly know what the Agriculture Department does. I mean, what stocks would they have to own to create a conflict? Is it Monsanto, a seed company? Well, that makes sense. Or a fertilizer company? Or is it, you know, John Deere, who makes farming equipment? Well, that makes sense. But who else? Is Apple a conflict? Is Walmart a conflict? I think the answer ended up being yes. And that's just for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Then there's 50 other agencies where each one you have to figure out the rules, get the data, try to figure out what's a conflict, go through these forms. So frankly, it was just kind of overwhelming. And given that there's already, you know, there's already plenty of other stories on my list to do, it just kept getting delayed. Luckily, what happened is that the top investigative editor at the Wall Street Journal, whose name is Mike Sikonolfi, I think got tired of hearing me say this would be a good series of stories to write, and just said, just go do it. And then he teamed me up with Rebecca Ballhouse, who is an amazing dogged reporter, and she and I then finally got motivated to dive in and start doing this. And what we did was, because it was intimidating, is I think what we did was in the beginning, this would be January of 2022, is that each day we reach out to two or three agencies each just to kind of get the ball rolling. We took a list of maybe 70 agencies. We divided them up. We started finding the contact information, and it was just a couple of agencies a day while we were doing our other work, just so that we kind of slowly ease into the process without getting blown away by how much work it was. So I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer to your question, but you know, that is what happened. I should also say, when I say it was a decade, that might have been a bit of an exaggeration, but it was certainly 7, 8, 9 years. I mean, I forget exactly when we stopped writing about stock trading in Congress, but it was a long time ago.
So I think till now, we have been kind of, I feel, taking the conflict of interest part for granted. Could you maybe set it up in the sense, like, so why is it problematic if, let's say, members of these committees or if these branches own stocks in which they're kind of involved in policy decision making or just, let's say, recommendations per se? So why is that a problem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a couple different ways of answering that question. I think the one way is that the public needs to have, it's important for the public to have the confidence in the government, that government officials are making decisions based on the public good and what's good for the country and the people and the industry. And so you want those public officials to have clean hands, to not have, to not be putting their thumb on the scale. And it just seems that, you know, if you are at the transportation department and you have stock in Ford or General Motors, that in the back of your mind somewhere, you know, you may be a very good lawyer, have be a policy expert, but if you have that financial interest, or if you're, if your kid's college fund has a bunch of transportation stocks, then you're just going to, I think, have a subtle bias toward bending public policy to help your own financial interest. In fact, that's what the law says. The law takes that same approach. I don't think, having looked at all these forms, spent a year writing about these things, I don't think that there are members of the government who are intentionally going to work for the government, invest in Google, and then change some policy in order to help Google. I don't think there's like blatant corruption like that. There may be cases like that, but we never saw. I think it's much more subtle. And I think, again, if you step back and you look at where we are as a country right now and what our, you know, all the concerns we have about our government from people outside of Washington, a lot of it goes to trusting government officials to make the best decisions. And therefore, you don't want them to have a financial interest in those decisions because you're going to undermine the public's trust in whatever they're doing. You know, another way, if you don't mind, there's a slightly different argument here, which I think is compelling, which is the rules in Congress. In Congress, as I mentioned, there are no rules, or very few rules. And there is no rules that prohibit people from working on issues in which they have investments. And their philosophical approach is different. They say, if you're an expert in agricultural policy, in farming policy, we want you to be on the farming committee because you know issues about farming. Me, Brody Mullins, I know nothing about farming. I should not be on the farming committee. I'd be an idiot. I have no idea what I'm doing. But well, some people who are experts in farming are experts because they were farmers. And who knows most about farming policy? Well, farmers, because they deal with this stuff all day long. They deal with the interest rates and the crops and this. And I mean, I don't even know what the issues are. So in Congress, they say it's okay to have a conflict of interest because if you're have a farming background, that means you know much more about farming policy than anyone else. And therefore, you should be on the farming committee making the farming rules. That makes sense. There are people who still have a conflict because they own stocks in Monsanto or they own... lots of members of Congress actually still own farms. And the way Congress deals with that conflict of interest is they say, disclosure, let's make it public. On your financial disclosure form, which the public can look at, which reporters can look at, which are public, you know, Congressman X says, you know, I own $250,000 in a farm and I'm on the agricultural committee. And so you know that I've got this conflict and I'm going to go about making farming policy. And the idea is that the public can decide. The difference in the executive branch is that while these are public officials, you don't know their names, you don't know who they are. They're somewhere in the bowels of the Department of Agriculture making some policy you've never heard of. And so there is very little disclosure of that person and what they're doing. And therefore, in the executive branch, they say, you can't do it. You cannot work at the agriculture department and own stock in farming companies.
Actually, that's a good point in the sense that, but do you think that that'll disincentivize a lot of, like, let's say, interest people who are very interested in, if I can take like the tech example, people who might be very interested in tech, who might work, I don't know, FCC is it, but because they can't invest or, you know, hold any holdings in these companies, that might discourage them to, you know, join these agencies. And because of that, you know, there's a loss of talent. Is that a huge factor, do you think?
Absolutely. That's 100% true. And, you know, that's a problem. I think in government, there's a give and take and sort of a push and a pull and a compromise on issues like this, where, you know, if you know, the government right now, the Federal Trade Commission, is pursuing rules and regulations of the tech industry. And it would seem like you'd want people who are making those rules who are experts, and those experts are people who come from Silicon Valley and have worked at those companies. And if you've worked at one of those companies and you've been successful, you have stock in that company. You have stock options. You still own the company. And under the federal rules, if you go to the FTC to work on those issues, you have to get rid of that stock. So that's a huge disincentive, especially to people who have stock options, you know, that they haven't yet gotten. Now, to be fair, the government has rules to deal with that. They may not be great rules, but they do say that if you come to the government with a lot of stock, let's say in Google, that has that you've had a huge, you have a huge capital gain in that stock because you've, you know, you started there 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and if you were to, the government would require you to sell that stock, you'd have a huge capital gains tax. The government has a policy in those cases for people to defer their capital gains tax so they don't get slammed with these taxes. But at the same time, you have to get rid of the Google stock. So yes, that is a disincentive. Now on the flip side, the argument goes, you know, if you're coming to work for the US government, for the Federal Trade Commission, that the mission of the government in creating these rules and regulations, you know, should be bigger and more powerful and more enticing to people to come work, and put aside, you know, temporarily those stocks that they have. You can also, you know, once you leave the government, go back and invest in Google again, of course, at today's price, not at the price of 15 years ago. But yeah, I mean, the issue you raise is 100% a problem, and it keeps it keeps people from working for the government because they're going to lose on their financial interest. But that's, you know, part of what Washington is. It's putting the public good above your personal financial interests, which is really what these rules are trying to do.
Right. I mean, so you touched on this, but I feel like this is a very important point in the sense that, like unless the government really pays well, like really, really well, then it really does not make, I feel it motivates this very like social justice type people to kind of work in these agencies where, you know, they are okay with leading like a very, again, I don't know what the salaries are or how much these people get paid, if they get paid really well or no, but I just feel like the way I'm hearing it, like it really motivates that kind of like selfless attitude type of people who are, you know, willing to, even though they might be talented, they're willing to like forego, you know, thousands of dollars of bonuses or salaries in other fields of work just to like work in the government. And I'm not sure if, and I don't even know if there's a correlation between like being the best people and like, you know, if being selfless and being the best at something. So I feel like, yeah, it's very interesting dynamic. Yeah.
And no, I you know, I completely agree. In terms of salaries, I'm not a complete expert on this, but I think that the president makes something like $400,000 a year, which is the highest salary. Members of Congress at the top level, I think make around $180,000, and all congressional staffers make less than that. So that's where you're capped at, you know, which is a decent amount compared to the rest of the country, but like that's not tech money. What's interesting is that I know at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I think some other industries that regulate mainly, I think, financial services, not tech, if I'm correct. There are exceptions to those salary caps. Because at the Securities and Exchange Commission, they know they can't recruit the top talent who really knows the ins and outs of how puts and options and credit default swaps work. In order to get people who know how that stuff works, you need to go to Wall Street, and you're getting someone who's making a ton of money. So in that case, they have exemptions where I know there are there maybe dozens or scores, not thousands, of people at the SEC who make a lot more money. In order to kind of deal with the issue that you're raising. I don't think that that's widespread, but it is a really good point. I mean, you know, one way of changing how the government works, perhaps making it better, would be to double or triple the salaries for people. Then you're saying, oh, I'm really smart. You know, I can make a ton of money in tech, or I can go work at the FTC regulating tech, and that there's a similar salary level. I think that on paper, you and I talking is a great idea. I think in reality, when a member of Congress goes to the, you know, the House floor and proposes a bill to boost salaries of government bureaucrats, you know, you don't have a job for very long.
Earlier, you mentioned the thing where, sorry, there was an echo there.
Okay.
You mentioned a part where you were talking about how it does not seem like people join just like they own like, let's say, Apple or Google stock, and then they walk into a particular department which maybe has some policy influence, and you know, it's not that blatant. But like in general, like, does that matter though, in the sense that if they do end up influencing policy and they hold, let's say, any stock that the industry that they're influencing on, I mean, it does not really matter, no? I mean, does it?
Yeah, I'm just saying, I don't think that there are a lot of bad people who are intentionally trying to boost their own stock portfolios by, you know, inserting a rule or regulation into the law for the purely to benefit their stock. I think it's more subtle. I don't think these are bad people. I think these are people who have either made mistakes or sort of not understood how things look, or think, oh, you know, how could I be influenced by the stocks that I own? And they don't realize sort of, you know, how it looks.
So I want to jump a little ahead in the sense that I'm reminded of, I think, two examples. One is, I think, the Microsoft example, the FDIC, where I think they wanted to choose like Microsoft as their primary cloud infra. And I think another example is where I think the cruise line example, I think, where I think the person's wife was kind of emailing the White House officials and trying to lobby for. I don't know, when I hear like such instances, it does seem like people are going overboard to kind of, you know, get something done that might be beneficial to them. Is that fair, or do you think I'm missing something?
Let's talk about both those. My colleague, Rebecca Ballhaus, reported on the Microsoft example more than I did. So I'm more of just like a reader and an observer on that one. But I found that one, just as a, you know, reader, to be sort of outrageous that the very people who are deciding at the FDIC or any agency who gets this big contract own stock in one of the four companies that can get the contract. I mean, we're talking about big cloud computing contracts. There's only four or five possible companies who can get that business. In fact, this might go to your point. There's only four or five companies who can get that business. And to me, you shouldn't be allowed to own stock in one of those companies, because then whether you're putting your thumb on the scale or it looks like you're putting your thumb on the scale, either way, you're undermining the public's trust in the government and in that decision. You know, if the people who award the contract to Microsoft own stock in Microsoft might have been the best company, but it, you know, that's obviously a conflict and people wouldn't trust that. And is it, you want to know that's the right decision. At the same time, and this might go to your point, the people who know best which cloud computing company is out there for that agency should be experts in tech policy and cloud computing. And if you're an expert in tech policy and cloud computing, you might have worked at Microsoft before, you might have worked at Silicon Valley, you're going to be sort of preordained to invest in that industry. So, you know, I think that sort of makes your point also. But to me, it's you know, there's lots of companies you can invest in the country. Do you have to invest in one of those four companies?
I know that's actually, I was actually thinking about the same thing where, you know, tech is not only Google or Apple or Microsoft. There's just a lot of companies to invest in tech. So, but even there, you know, it's a bit vague in the sense like I don't know how people will draw up like rules or regulations based on like what you can invest. Let's say you can't invest in cloud companies or you can't invest in B2B companies. So I don't know how like implementation wise that'll work. I think the simplest is, I think, blanket ban itself, like, I think makes the most easiest. So so that's also.
The rules say, and we can talk more detail about the rules if you want to, but the rules technically say that you can't own more than $15,000 in a stock in a particular company that you could influence, or more than $50,000 in an index fund, in an industry-specific fund that you could influence. So I think if you own any Microsoft, you shouldn't be working on the cloud computing contract. But you could own a tech index fund, which is, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, you know, it has all the companies, of up to $50,000, you know, or if you go even broader and just invest in the NASDAQ, which is very tech heavy, then you can own whatever you want. There are plenty of broad-based index funds that government employees can own with no consequence and still work on whatever they're working on.
So maybe I want to extend this a little bit in the sense that, so till now, I think we have spoken about the problem of conflict of interest and why it may be wrong or not the ideal way to go about approaching these problems. But these agencies also have some rules and regulations. I think one you mentioned, you know, people working at that agency cannot, let's say, have more than $15,000 of a single stock. So that is one. Are there other mechanisms where they have tried to curtail the problem as much as possible? And one is that enough? And implementation wise, also is that implemented rigorously?
So you put your finger on two great issues. The first is that this 1978 law, which turns out now to be outdated, says pretty clearly you can't own stock in companies that you oversee, that you could influence. Then there's a million exemptions to it, and it's now almost 50 years old and has lots of problems. Agencies on their own are free to create additional rules, and many have. At the Food and Drug Administration, for example, they say, okay, beyond that rule, here's a list of 70 companies that you're not allowed to own. That makes it pretty clear. You can't own Amgen. You can't own Johnson & Johnson. You can't own, and that's just, you know, that seems like a very clear rule. Now, we found that there was some mistakes there, but even so, that makes it clear to employees what they can own and what they can't own. A bunch of agencies have rules like that. The Federal Communications Commission created a rule that says you can't own stocks in, I think, five different batches. One was something like, I'm forgetting the exact language, you can't own stock in a telecommunications provider or something like that. And then it's sort of up to the employee to say, well, what is a telecommunications provider? Is that Google? Is that Verizon? Is that Comcast? Is that, you know, there's all sorts of different shades of gray there to figure out what that is. At the FDA, it's clear you can't own these companies. At the SEC, they have a pretty strong rule. They were one of the strongest agencies that we found where there is very few conflicts at all, because they say you can't work on any investigations involving any companies that you own. That's very clear. And because the SEC is trying to bust people for, you know, for having their own conflicts of interest, they had to be very careful about SEC employee conflict of interest. But then your other question about, so the answer there is that some agencies have additional rules and some don't. Another real problem we found was this implementation, that when this 1978 law took effect, I'm going to make up some numbers here, the government was a little bit smaller, but more importantly, a smaller percentage of people owned stock at all. Now, I don't want to say everyone, but, you know, 50% of Americans or more own stock in companies via their 401ks or just on their own. I imagine that in the government, it might be more like 70 or 80 or 90%. We didn't find many people who didn't own stock. There were a few. Maybe, I would even say maybe 95% of people owned had some sort of financial investments in the stock market. The point I'm trying to make is that the staff that were in charge of implementing these rules in 1978 are the same staff now, but there's just so much more work to do because there's more employees of these forms, there's more stock trading, there's more wealth, there's more people who have forms that are 50 pages long with all these various stocks. And these staff members, if you think of it from their point of view, let's say you're at the Environmental Protection Agency, let's say that 40 years ago, you know, you had 10,000 people filing a form, but only 1,000 of them owned any stock. Well, you look at those forms and you have more time to figure out if someone has a conflict or not. Now, everyone's got stock. And if you're the environmental, if you're the EPA, you know, what is a conflict? Like, I would think if you come across a form of someone who owns Ford, you say, well, we're the EPA. Well, that's not a conflict. But then you think, oh, wait a second, the EPA regulates tailpipe emissions. and Ford makes cars. Okay, well, that is a conflict. What does this person work on tailpipe emissions, or do they work on, pick some other issue. I was going to say electric vehicles. Let's say this person works on mining issues. Well, if they work on mining issues, then they're allowed to own Ford. But the point is that for each person and each stock, you have to go through this mental exercise of, does this person have a conflict or not? Just because you're the EPA, you can still own, Chevron if you do work on tailpipe emissions, because then Chevron has nothing to do with that. So the staff have to go through all these forms and figure all this out. And it's hard for them to figure out, every signal, every conflict in every case. I mean, we're just talking about the cloud computing business. So you're the lawyer at the EPA that needs to clear all these forms for people. Let's say someone owns Apple. Well, now the EPA person's got to figure out who's Apple's cloud computing company, and does this person work on that? So there's so much more work for these folks that implementation, I think, has suffered just because they're overwhelmed. It's not their job to sit around and try to figure out, what all these companies are doing and figure out what the various agency employees are doing and whether they have a conflict. But that's kind of the position they've been put in. And therefore, I think the implementation has suffered.
I think I've also, I don't know if this is accurate, but I remember reading, if people leave that organization and if they are under investigation, it becomes very, very difficult to kind of pursue that. And I think at least one incident where I read, I think that person left and it became very difficult to kind of pursue that whole matter, and they had to let it go. I think that, I'm not sure. But people leaving that organization also tends to impact, no?
Correct. So the rules are enforced mostly by the agencies. And once you're not an employee of that agency, the agency can't do anything to you. You no longer work there. They can't, dock your pay, or they have no recourse once you leave. In one really interesting case we found, I told you that the Food and Drug Administration has a list of stocks you can't own. We found a guy who owned a bunch of those stocks on the list you couldn't own. And we contacted him and he said, well, the EPA gave me an exemption. They said, it's fine. We went to the EPA and they said, I'm sorry, we went to the Food and Drug Administration. They said, it's fine. We asked the Food and Drug Administration and they said, no, that's a mistake. He's not allowed to own those stocks. So then the Food and Drug Administration went to the guy and said, hey, you can't own these stocks. And he said, well, I want to keep the stocks. And they said, well, then, you're going to get in trouble. And he said, well, what if I quit? And they said, well, then we can't do anything. So he quit. Now, in fairness to this guy, I think he was in his around 60. He was close to retirement. He was thinking about retirement. And then the FDA is like, hey, you just sell all these stocks that, for your retirement. He was like, I'll just go ahead and retire. But the point is, yes, the rules are basically only enforced by the agencies. So once you leave the agency, you actually see this in Congress a lot too. It's kind of funny that members of Congress get involved in these thorny ethics investigations. And it's oftentimes once they realize that they're going to get in trouble, that they're going to get sanctioned or penalized by the ethics committees, they just quit. And then the ethics committees can't do anything anymore.
I mean, that's a bit messed up, I feel. At least the way when you hear it, you just feel like, I don't know how to put this, but let's say I lived in a locality and I committed a murder, and now when it's time for prosecution, I decide to leave the locality, and now I'm out of jurisdiction. You can't really prosecute me because I don't live there anymore.
So it's like you're driving a car in California and you're speeding, and the cop is trying to pull you over. You just drive to Nevada, and then you're okay.
Right. Yeah. So there is something off about it, but maybe that's how rules work. I think, I don't know. Yeah. Another thing which came out is, I feel like there seems to be a lot of variance between how seriously people take all these issues in different agencies. And I'm guessing this is mostly how serious the top guy is. By that I mean, let's say the head of the organization, how seriously they want to think about this. I think you gave an example, I don't know if it was the FCC or SEC, where they really don't want to be seen their employees having any conflict of interest when they are going, when they are pursuing other matters with conflict. So that seems like a very top-down strategy where, you know, they are always on the lookout. At least it seems like that. So there's like, it's mostly at the behest of the agencies itself, right? Is that fair or?
I think that's fair. I think, yeah, I think you're exactly right on the Securities and Exchange Commission. They just couldn't afford to have anyone challenge their integrity by having their own conflicts of interest as they pursue other people with conflicts or other people are insider trading. And I think another point, though, is that I've said a couple of times that these rules were created in 1978. They require members of the executive branch to fill out these forms once a year that they hand into an ethics official who, you know, basically puts them in a file cabinet. And that happened for 40 plus years. And no one ever looked at these forms. And for 40 years, people just fill out these forms and put them in a desk drawer and they went away. And I think during that time, it's just natural for people to sort of get a little sloppy or start to sort of ignore the rules because there's no consequence. No one's looking at these forms. So when we came along as reporters, and probably for the first time ever, asked all these agencies for all of their forms, we sort of found ourselves in sort of an enviable spot where people had just sort of gotten lazy. People were bending the rules. People knew they could do whatever they want and there was very little penalty. So they did whatever they wanted to. So for us, we sort of walked into a goldmine of examples of conflicts just because it had kind of been going on for so long.
So like, why was nobody looking into this? Like, is it mostly because it's like a very unsexy matter or, you know, I don't know. Like, why do you think?
It turns out that it was very sexy, you know? But yes, I think I would guess that people felt maybe the way I felt that this is intimidating to look at all these agencies. The agencies make it hard to get the forms. You know, it took us a lot of manpower, Rebecca Ballhouse and I, a lot of manpower to get the forms before we even looked at them. So, you know, there are laws being considered. There are bills in Congress now that would simply require all these agencies to take their forms and put them on a searchable website. I think that would, that disclosure would handle some of the issues that you're talking about because people could see them right away. And I think that if you're the employee and you knew that you're putting your financial disclosures out for anyone to see in the public, you might sort of self-regulate and be more careful about your investments because you know people are watching. I think, you know, one of the good things that journalism does and what the Wall Street Journal did in this particular case is that we shine a light on this. So the person who's right now sitting at their desk at the Pentagon filling out their trading form is going to think, oh, man, what if the Wall Street Journal looks at my form? All right, maybe I shouldn't buy Lockheed Martin stock. Or maybe I shouldn't invest in this, you know, in Google if I'm the one deciding who gets the big IT contract. And, you know, that's a value that the journal and does as a public service. But if the forms were simply put online, I think that might be enough to pressure people to be more careful. Or to follow the rules is another way of putting it.
When you were reaching out to be, I mean, so... Like, I'm just trying to put myself into the employee's shoes, I think, where it would be spooky if I was, let's say, working with the FCC and I suddenly got a call from one of the reporters from Wall Street Journal asking me about, like, I don't know, what stocks I own or... So was it difficult to, like, talk to people and, like, get information from them, or were they kind of obligated to talk to you, or was there pressure or any sort of things like that?
That's a great question about reporting that, you know, lots of reporters make sort of deals with sources that you'll talk on background or off the record, as in you'll talk to a source on a not for attribution basis. And that's a customary way of how reporters, especially in Washington, deal with sources. In this case, our editor, Mike Sicanolfi, basically demanded that we don't talk to anyone without it being on the record. And the reason was we had these forms. We had the story. We had the information. It was up to the employees to explain themselves on the record and in a way that we could use to help explain their rationale or their decisions. So what we found in, I think, almost 100% of cases is that we would call people and say, hey, you know, you work at, I'm making this up, you know, the Federal Trade Commission, and you own Google stock, and your agency is investing Google or Facebook, you know, this looks like a conflict. And they would say, I'll only talk to you off the record. And we would say, no, we're only talking on the record. And all of a sudden they'd start explaining themselves. Because, you know, we had the document. The sentence I just said was true and factual according to their report. So they were sort of forced to explain and wanted to explain. It was good for them to explain what they were doing. So in this case, it was great that we sort of held people's feet to the fire, and almost every single person spoke to us on the record. And lots of people, you know, should be fair, lots of people who we spoke to had very good explanations and didn't end up in the story. Yes, I had this Google stock, but, again, I'm making this up, but like, you know, my husband worked there for many years and it's below the $15,000 threshold. And I told my bosses that I'm not allowed to work on Google issues because I had this conflict, and therefore I only work on mergers involving the oil industry. Well, then, you know, even though it looks bad at first, that's a pretty good explanation on why it's okay to work at the FTC and own Google stock, because you work on energy issues. But then there's other people, you know, we talked to a guy, or my colleague, Rebecca Ballhouse, talked to a guy at the Pentagon who I think worked in the acquisitions office, and he kept buying Lockheed Martin stock. And the quote that he gave us, that he gave Rebecca, is in the story. So I'll get it wrong a little bit here, but, you know, he said something like, well, you know, the Pentagon's constantly giving Lockheed Martin these big government contracts, so it seemed like a good company to invest in. You know, that's true, but you shouldn't be working at the Pentagon when you do that.
So I'm a little curious here. So, but I understand if you can't answer this. You keep saying we spoke to this guy, this other guy. I'm very curious, like, how do you end up talking to these people? Like, in the sense, I don't know phone numbers or emails work in the US. At least in India, it's very difficult to, let's say, reach out to people. So one example is how I reached out to you, right? So I reached out to you because your email was publicly available, I think, on Wall Street Journal. Or if it's not available, I tried your first name, last name, and then wallstreetjournal.com. There it's accessible and maybe we can talk. But some of these people will be like, I don't know, employees, or these are not public figures, right? So I don't know if you can answer this, but how do you end up like even connecting with these people? Isn't it very difficult?
Yeah, in America, it's very easy to find someone's phone number or email. Most government employees will have the same domain name, you know, at epa.gov, and, you know, same idea, first name dot last name or some variation of that, which you can find. There's also lots of these people are, you know, because our government is open generally and public, lots of these people's names are on public filings somewhere. You know, they're on some rule or regulation, or there's some, and their email address is there, or their phone number. In some case, we had to go to the media relations office for that agency and say, hey, we're writing about so-and-so. But in general, it was not hard to find to find people through their government email or phone numbers. On top of that, we have a staff of people at the Wall Street Journal, including a guy named Jim Oberman, who's got some special sauce program, something where if you give him a name, he'll give you 10 possible phone numbers. So we relied on him a lot too, where we just call these 10 numbers. Hey, I'm looking for so-and-so, or, you know, getting wrong numbers, or getting numbers are disconnected. So finding the people was not incredibly challenging. You know, in fact, I should say, now that I'm thinking about it, there were two or three people. So there's so much information in America that's public. There was two or three people where either we couldn't find their phone numbers or couldn't find their emails, or they were not responding to us. I live in Washington, D.C. Most of these government employees are in Washington, D.C. I would find their physical home addresses and write them a note or a letter, put it in an envelope, and drive their houses and drop it off. I think I did that three times. In all three cases, those people called us back within 24 hours.
Oh my, okay. That is a bit spooky, actually. Okay.
You know, honestly, there are a couple times there's a little spooky for me. But you know what we're trying to say is, there's this public information out there that you file that says that you own stock in a company that looks like you might have violated the law, or you're going to look bad in the Wall Street Journal. We want to give you the opportunity to defend yourself, to either tell us we're wrong, you know, we're happy to be wrong and take you out of the story, to tell us why this happened, to give an explanation, to explain yourself. It'll put your point of view out there. So when I'm going and knocking on your door, I'm not saying like, hey, you know, you're a jerk, I'm going to make you look terrible. It's, I need you to defend yourself because I have this information that makes you look bad, and I need information that helps you explain and justify your decisions.
So I'm actually kind of surprised how open it is in the US. I have tried reaching out to a few public officials in India. I think it's very difficult. Phone number is out of the question if I'm not wrong, but even emails are very notoriously difficult to find. Like I've had a few, like I've tried to have like a few government officials on the podcast, and it's been extremely difficult. Anyways, so there's another digression I want to take, which is, so sometimes I feel it's best to say no comment in some of these stories. Like I feel no matter what they say, they end up looking bad. I don't know. Like when I read these things, I'm just like, it's looking bad. Like, so do you think sometimes it's just best to say no comment and move on? Like any thoughts on that?
That's a tough question for me, cause I'm sort of on the other side of that. I mean, I would always prefer people to talk. There's obviously people who from time to time and, you know, over the years in the newspaper journalism or broadcast journalism who start talking and just say stupid things and don't help their own case. But I would never tell someone not to talk because it's sort of against my own interest, you know?
Let me put this other way. Let's say I was a reporter who was talking to you about an issue. Would you make a comment? I mean, this is a bit, it's not a good setup, but I don't know.
I mean, in this case, we had the document. I'm calling you because you're doing something that you've publicly reported that I found that doesn't look right. So you can say no comment and I can go with what I have, and that's fine. I think in the most cases, it's beneficial for people to talk. Let's go back to this guy at the Pentagon with the Lockheed Martin stock. His explanation was, you know, really curious. At the same time, he said, by the way, I didn't know that the Pentagon was going to give this contract to Lockheed. I didn't know anything specific. I just know generally the Pentagon gives a lot of money to Lockheed Martin. So he's saying, hey, I didn't trade on inside information. Like that's important because, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Justice Department are reading these stories. And if he had not, you know, it looked like some people could look at that form and say, oh, this guy knew that Lockheed Martin was going to get this contract and he bought Lockheed Martin stock. That's a violation of the law. You can go to jail. Certainly lose your job. He's saying, no, that's not what happened. I didn't know any specific thing was happening. I just know in general that Lockheed Martin gets a lot of contracts. So some people might say that his comment looked silly. At the same time, he was able to give himself a defense that, like, I did not break the law. This may look bad, but I didn't break the law. If he didn't talk at all, it would look like he broke the law.
The fact that you're from the Wall Street Journal, does that help your case, or does that make your case harder?
I think probably 90% of the time it helps, because we have a very good reputation. people know we're serious. People know we're going to be fair. And to a degree, people might be scared. You know, you don't want to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, so you could want to talk your way out of it.
We spoke about a few cases. Do you think that across all these agencies, and there are many of them, in general, do you think this is like a rampant problem? By rampant, I mean, I think I would say, let's say if even 30% of the people were indulging in something like this, I think it would be a rampant issue. Or do you think like there are only few people who are really, you know, the culprits here, and most of the agency is pretty clean? Any idea, any thoughts on that?
That's a hard question to assess. I mean, as I said in the beginning, I don't think that there's a lot of bad people in the government who are trying to manipulate the system to for their own financial gain. I'm sure there are some, certainly not the majority. I think a lot of people just sort of got away with slowly bending the rules over years and years and years and got themselves in a position that looks bad. You know, I think that most people who work in government because they're trying to do the right thing and help the country, and they're giving up, you know, tech riches or working on Wall Street or, you know, being a lawyer for a big company. Most people who work in government are highly educated, lots of lawyers. You know, these are people who could make a lot more money working somewhere else. So they're giving that up in order to work for the public good. so I don't think they're bad people. I don't know about rampant. It's sort of hard to define. I mean, you know, we put numbers in the story, and there's all sorts of different degrees of what people are doing. Like, some were just mistakes, some could be explained, some seemed a little closer to the line. Some people had been investigated. Some people, you know, were pushed out of their jobs or quit their jobs because they were across the line. But I don't think those people were, in general, bad people. I think that they sort of wanted to have it both ways. They wanted to keep their big profitable stocks while working for the government, even though that created a conflict.
I don't know. I would consider that bad. I mean, I would consider that as bad people. But maybe you and I look at this very differently, I think. But anyways, a series of articles we published, obviously in the Wall Street Journal, about the issues that we're talking about. Before you started writing this, did you expect, like, was this the story you were kind of expecting?
No. You know, I mentioned that we've written these stories about Congress where these types of investments were permitted. And, you know, one of the reasons that we were slow in getting to the executive branch is that these types of investments are not permitted. So we spent many months collecting these forms. And, you know, I literally thought we're going to open these forms and there's going to be nothing there, which would have been to be very easy to go through the forms because there's no stock holdings. And we'd move on and we'd say to our editor, hey, you know, we spent 2 months on this and it was, we gave it the old college try and we did this good amount of investigative work and there's nothing here. And that's great. It's good there's nothing here. And in fact, you know, in, I think it was April when we first looked at the first batch of forms that we got back and we started with the Federal Trade Commission for a couple of reasons. One is they only have about 100 employees who are required to fill out these forms. So it was a more manageable amount of people. And also the Federal Trade Commission is a high profile agency. They're the ones who are leading the regulation of tech companies. So, you know, we knew we were looking for Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google, you know, we knew those companies and we knew. And so anyway, when we first opened these forms, we thought, well, surely we're not going to find anyone at the FTC who owns stock in Google or Facebook or Amazon. And within seconds, we're seeing all these people own stock in Google and Facebook and Amazon. And my whole sort of worldview switched from, we're not going to find anything here to, holy crap, like, what's going on here? That was just the Federal Trade Commission. You know, what happens when we go to the Energy Department and to the FDA and the Pentagon? And, you know, it just kept going.
Were you surprised with the response that the article got?
What do you mean? What sort of response?
If I'm not wrong, I think there are multiple investigations because of the articles that you wrote, right?
Right. Okay.
In that sense, like, did you see that coming? I mean, was that like very obvious to you? Because I mean, from where I'm sitting, I don't know. Like, sometimes people read stuff, but then they may not act on it, right? Act on information as well.
So, you know, when you write a story or publish stories in the Wall Street Journal or elsewhere, you never really know what the reaction is going to be. You never quite control it. I mean, because it's something that Rebecca and I worked on for almost a year, you know, we thought it was outrageous. And then, like, you know, there'd be like front, you know, the hearings and be on the news all the time. And, you know, it didn't reach that level of public recognition. But, you know, but we wrote five stories. I think five stories in the first week that when the stories came out, and then more stories later on. But we unroll like five stories to like start this package. And one of those stories was just about the rules. So we knew that a big problem with this system was that the rules were broken. And so therefore we figured some smart people at the agencies or in Congress are going to try to fix those rules. And so it was not surprising to see bills come out afterwards. Those bills are sort of slowly working their way through the system. It's unclear whether there will be any changes. I mean, I kind of thought if we looked at 70 agencies and then there's Congress, there's lots of people who could say, hey, these rules need to be updated. So in that regard, I think we sort of, we had identified the rules themselves being a problem. And therefore, if we're shining a light on those broken rules for all the country to see on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, that would make sense for some people to try to fix those rules. And that's what's happening.
So I want to extend that in the sense, like any other solutions that you might have, like one is obviously fixing the rules. Earlier, I think on the episode, we kind of touched on, I think if the information was more public, then people would be disincentivized to maybe, you know, commit any crimes or maybe just be more aware of the situation. Any other solutions that you might have to how we can avoid this conflict of interest maybe?
Yeah, so just to be clear on one thing. So my job is not to, you know, say this is how we should fix things. And, you know, here's my plan for fixing the problems. But I can tell you like what other people are saying. And one of them seems like the easiest solution, the most straightforward in terms of bill becoming a law, is probably doing something to make these forms more publicly available. I mean, each of these agencies on their own, if they choose to, could put them on a website, you know, within a day. There are several bills in Congress to do that. That's probably the most likely change that gets enacted. Now, it's been a year and it has not been enacted. But it's working its way through the system. That the reason that's an easy solution is that it doesn't require much work and it's not telling people what they can and can't do. It's just saying, let's make these forms, let's just make these forms public and then let disclosure, you know, work its magic. There are other proposals out there that say members of Congress should not be allowed to, I'm sorry, members of the executive branch are not allowed to own any stock in any company. There are some proposed rules that say you can't own any stock in any industry that your agency regulates at all. Get rid of de minimis rules, get rid of the fact that employees can file for exemptions or waivers, like, you know, get rid of all those. There's all sorts of different proposals. What makes things complicated in terms of creating a law is that Congress really likes creating laws for other people, but not for themselves. There's a lot of scrutiny about the stock holdings of some members of Congress. And now there's this scrutiny of stock holdings by members of the executive branch. So Congress wants to create rules to regulate the executive branch, but they don't want that to turn around and apply to them. So it's sort of like this difficult dance that, you know, you want to pass legislation for the other guy, but not for you. But there's a worry that once you start doing that, someone's going to say, well, wait a second, shouldn't this apply to everyone in Congress? And then all of a sudden, Congress is regulating themselves, which they don't want to do. So I think that's a little bit of the political dynamic that's going on here. I mean, in Washington, the way that most ethics regulations get passed is that there's a big scandal, and then Congress reacts to it. I don't know if we've created that scandal, There might be another scandal coming to sort of push people over the top. When we were writing about stock holdings by lawmakers in 2010 or so, Rebecca Ballhaus and I wrote a whole ton of stories about that topic, and legislation was slowly moving along like it is now on this topic. And then 60 Minutes had a big story that really repeated a lot of stuff that we already written, but 60 Minutes is a big hammer, a big megaphone. And they wrote their piece, or their 60 Minutes piece aired on a Sunday about how all these members of Congress own stock and things they regulated. And like within a week, the bill had passed, you know, because everyone just was afraid of 60 Minutes. So, you know, it could be something like that where more people write about this or more people focus the public's attention on it. I mean, if members of the public knew that this was going on, if everyone read that these Wall Street Journal stories, they would call their members of Congress and say, this is outrageous. So it's just a matter of, you know, sort of getting this information out to people and how they respond.
The biggest learning for me there was the platform where the news is delivered matters a lot. Like when you mentioned the 60 minute part where, you know, it aired on, I think, Sunday or Monday, and then immediately, that was very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's not to say that, I mean, the journal has 2, 3, 4 million readers. I mean, that's a lot. But, you know, 60 minutes can hit 25 million people. So it's just, you know, broadcast television is just a bigger megaphone than we have.
What do you think was like the most difficult part of writing the story? Like, was it the writing itself, or reaching out to people, or going through documents, talking to people?
Good question. I don't think there was a part that was really difficult. It was just a lot. It was a lot of work. I think that the hardest parts, I would have to say, are just getting these forms, and because it was sort of thankless. No one knew what we were doing. We weren't expecting to find anything amazing. So we're sort of like collecting these forms in a way just to kind of check a box, because we didn't think we'd find anything in the form. At least I didn't think we'd find anything in the forms. So it was, I think that, you know, it was a potential huge waste of time calling, you know, one agency after next, you know, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, you know, barely know what they do. You have to figure out who their press person is, who deals with the media from them, call that person. They don't want to call you back. You know, you have to hound them to get them on the phone and then ask them what's the process for how we get the forms, and then fill out some form. And then the people who control that form say, well, you need the names of FDIC employees or to fill out another form. You know, that's just for one agency. I mean, that was not fun. You know, there's no reward. The reward is like actually getting the forms, which takes, you know, could come months later. I mean, looking at the forms, even though that was overwhelming because we literally had thousands and thousands and thousands of forms that we're looking at by hand, you know, flipping through on our computers. That was laborious, but it was sort of like, there you're sort of like hunting for gold. Like, you know, it was kind of a little more exciting. I mean, you could spend an hour going through forms and not see anything, but then you see someone in the transportation department with $100,000 in American Airlines, and you're like, ah, you know, got something here, you know? So even though that was hard work, it was kind of exciting. And because of what we'd seen, we knew we were going to find it. Like, you get a stack of documents, and you know, there's going to be something in here. We just need to go find it. Yeah, you know, there's one other thing. So Rebecca and I went through these forms and kind of eyeball looking for examples and flagging them of things that we can go and report. But there was so much information. You know, in the U.S. government, there's so much information that is public that sometimes there's too much information. In this case, you know, we went through tens and tens of thousands of these forms. And our editor wanted to know big numbers, big broad numbers. How many people own Google? How much Google do they own? How much tech stocks do people own? At the Food and Drug Administration, what percentage of people own food and drug stocks and how much the value is? That's something that we couldn't do because we said too much information. So because the Wall Street Journal has a lot of resources, we turned to three folks who knew software and computers and basically designed they built from the ground up a program that could take these documents, pull all the financial information from the documents, standardize them, put them in a searchable spreadsheet, and they really built this computer system just for this reporting process, where we could literally put into it Ford Motor Corp, and a list of all the people in the government who owned Ford Motor Corp would come out, and when they bought the stock, when they sold it, how much they bought, how much they sold. And that was something that like really elevated our reporting, because we could, you know, pull in this huge amount of data and pull it into one place where we could see it and be able to say ultimately what, you know, the most important finding in these stories was that one out of five top executive branch officials own a stock in a company that their agency oversees. That's a number that Rebecca and I couldn't just, you know, eyeball. It was just too much stuff. They had to synthesize all this data and pull it in. And it's amazing that I could never do on my own. And that really brought things to light. But it sort of shows that, you know, how the Wall Street Journal works with reporters who are sort of in the weeds, interviewing people and looking at documents, and then other types of reporters who can deal with huge amounts of data and build data sets and build tables and charts and graphs and stuff to really bring things to life.
That's something I never thought about, actually, in a sense, like when I read an article, I just assume like, you know, the reporter ends up doing everything where, you know, they either call people, they'll go through the story, or they'll call people and then they write stuff down. Like, we never think about like, you know, all the work that goes when they are like analyzing reports, or we just, at least I just assume that, you know, they're looking at the reports like this and making notes and
that's what I was doing. But again, at the agriculture department, I think there was 40,000 forms we got. Just, you know, each form is, let's say, 12 pages long, 12 pages long. That's one agency. Multiply that by, that's a bigger agency. You know, the FTC was smaller, only 100 people. But still, like, the human brain can't synthesize that. You need to, and these guys just built the system from the ground up. That was amazing.